Welcome to Changelog and Friends, a weekly talk show about all things self-hosted. Big shout out to our friends and partners at fly.io, the home of changelog.com. Launch your apps, launch your databases, launch your AI near your users. Learn more at fly.io. Okay, let's talk. What's up, friends? I'm here with Sama Alam Naylor, Senior Developer Advocate at Sentry. So we've been working with Sentry for many years now, and I love Sentry. We use Sentry. It's so helpful for us. But we don't write many bugs here at Changelog. We're just that good. But I do say often how many teams use Sentry. And that number has grown over the years. It was 40,000, then it's 70,000, then it's 90,000. And now 100,000 plus teams use Sentry. Numbers don't lie. Check the NASDAQ scoreboard. Can you believe that, Sama? What are your thoughts on Sentry's impact to software teams?
Do you know what? I'm not surprised. It's a quality product. And I'm not just talking about that because I work for Sentry, but because I've used Sentry. And I think its success is also due to the fact that it supports over 100 SDKs and frameworks. Like any programming language you want to use, unless it's ridiculously obscure, Sentry's got an SDK for that. Whether it's an official maintained SDK or whether it's a community SDK, there's a way that you can implement Sentry in your project. With a few lines of code, you don't need to really do much to get its benefit. And I think that's really powerful also in showing that people want to make Sentry work for their frameworks or their languages of choice because it works. And the fact that you can self-host Sentry as well, it shows how valuable it is and shows how valuable Sentry knows it is to people. The fact that it's open and out there and you can use it and configure it to your specifications at the code level if you want. And if you want to not bother about that and pay for it, then you can do that too. I'm not surprised, and I'm not surprised that it's growing. I sound biased, obviously, but it's the best error monitoring solution I have used in my dev career of many years. And as a front-end dev, it feels intuitive. I think a lot of these error monitoring solutions are very back-end focused. They're very stack tracy and not really geared up with a good developer experience. Like, here are some logs, here are some things to spit out. You can read them if you care. But with Sentry, it seems to appeal to more developers because of the way it's been engineered. The amount of SDKs that are available makes it appeal to more developers. And you can get started in Sentry in so many different frameworks in less than a minute. And all the instructions are in the app and they point you to documentation if you need it. It's, you know, a joy to use. And so I'm not surprised that that many people use it.
I'm glad you're not surprised, because I'm not surprised either. It's an amazing tool. We love it. We use it. Go to sentry.io. Use the code changelog. That will get you $100 off the team plan. It's basically 3.5 months free, or almost 4 months, but code changelog will get you $100 off the team plan. Use it. Love it. Sentry. We love it. Sentry.io. That's Sentry.io. Sentry.io. Well, Alex, finally here, finally sitting down. We've met face-to-face briefly.
In Raleigh, funnily enough, I think it was.
Yeah, right in your backyard, basically, for all things open. We're going to go back there again this year. Are you going to go back again this year? What do you think?
Yeah, my talk was just accepted. I got the email yesterday. So you try and stop me. It's 20 minutes down the road, so really, I've got no excuse.
That's right. So born and raised in the UK, now you live in the tech triangle. What do they call that? Tech triangle? Is that what it is?
Just the triangle, I think.
The triangle. Okay.
People not from Raleigh call it RDU. Other people right. call it the triangle. Yeah.
And what is RDU? I know Raleigh Durham. What's the U?
Raleigh Durham, as in DU Durham.
Oh, okay.
Like,
gotcha.
Like the airport code.
Gotcha. That makes sense then. Okay. I mean, I've flown in there many a times. I think I've been to North Carolina, to Raleigh specifically, on 3 occasions, all things open. And Jared and I don't always get to go together. I've been there 3 times. He's been there, I think, 3 times as well. But one of those times was not together. But we always go to Sullivan's downtown to eat steak when we're there. I don't know if you, have you been? Do you go out and around into downtown?
Well, there's Angus Barn if you want a proper steak.
Okay. Well, I'll take a recommendation. I've been going to Sullivan's. That's pretty, they're solid. Sullivan's is solid.
Sullivan's is okay. But I mean, it's no, like you're from Austin, right? Where you get proper beef.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just there for, twice actually, Texas Linux Fest and DevOps Days Austin just happened.
I wish I'd have known you're coming back because I'd have taken you out for some proper beef.
Yeah. We went to Terry Black's and that was pretty nice.
Oh, that's proper. Well, I mean, yeah. They're kind of like, I don't know. I feel like they're obviously great folks, and I'm not knocking anybody for making great beef, but there are some up and comers that need more attention than Terry Black's.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, Terry's was good because it was like touristy and we wanted to eat on a Monday. And most of the places are shut on a Monday.
Oh, yeah. Mondays are like shut down for any barbecue spot, right? Like, it's not going to happen. Yeah. I mean, they're not open. They're literally not open. They're like, we've worked and now we're done. So that's how it works. Well, good to have you back here in Austin. I know that I actually was going to go to Texas Linux Fest? Is that what it was?
Yeah. The one down by I think it was at Palmer Event Center down by the water.
Yeah. And I happen to have my dear cousin. And she's basically a sister. You know how some family is like their label is X, but really they're a lot more like Y. And so she's my cousin, but she's a lot more like a sister than simply just a cousin. And so when she's in town, I throw everything out the window and it's dedicated to like spending time with her. And so she came into town and I couldn't go to Texas Linux Fest. And I wanted to. So bummer about that.
That's how it goes sometimes.
Yeah, it is how it goes sometimes. But, you've been in and around the Linux world for a while. You run a podcast, you write a blog, you are the original author of Perfect Media Server, which I have used and did not know that you were the maintainer and original author of until literally this morning when I was like, what the heck else does Alex do? Let me see. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I've used this guide in some cases to sort of get more information on what a perfect media server might be like. And I was actually on a journey towards the end of 2022, going into 2023, having spent many years building out a media server, never doing it properly. And when I say properly, I mean having Linux as the operating system, right? Something built on Linux. My media server was Plex always, but for a long time, I ran it as the PMS server on Mac. And that was fine. But there were some limitations, obviously. Macs do run it very well. I don't know if they have quick... I know Intel-based CPU Macs.
The new Macs are pretty good because they have their, what's it called? Video toolkit or something like hardware encoding.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do the new Macs sip power at idle when they're sat there on your desk, but also the hardware encoding is pretty good. We were just talking to Casey Liss on Self-Hosted about... he came on to talk about the Vision Pro, the podcast. And we ended up digressing a little bit and talking about Plex because it's the gateway drug for everybody into self-hosting.
It sure is, yeah.
You know, you think, right, well, I've got this Plex server running on this. For me, this is sort of going back 10 years now. I bought a Synology box and I was like, right, well, I've got this thing in my house that's always on. Surely it could be doing something else for me. Oh, what's this Plex thing? And then it snowballed and now as many services as I can self-host in my life, I do. So like, self-hosted Google Photos clone with an app called Image, for example, Nextcloud to replace Dropbox, and the list goes on and on and on. But as part of that journey, there was a lot of mistakes made and a lot of technology had to kind of catch up. So again, going back sort of 10 years, moving out of the Synology sort of training wheels mode, where you have an app store and you have a GUI and all this kind of stuff, eventually you start finding where the edges are, you know, like when you go bowling and they got the little bumper rails up.
Oh, yeah.
You feel like that's the Synology experience, really. And so I moved on to Unraid, and the cycle repeated after a year or so. I was like, oh, well, Unraid's more flexible. It's real Linux underneath. It's got, you know, XFS file systems and EXT4, and I've got parity checks, and I've got all the apps I could ever want and stuff like that. And this was before Unraid had Docker support. So way back in the beginning, I used to maintain VMs for Unraid, which I used to maintain like an Arch Linux package repository for Unraid that people could install a lot of their media collection apps onto VMs on top of Unraid. And then Docker came along, and it just seemed like a natural progression to kind of turn that into a container maintaining team. So that's where linuxserver.io came from. It was sort of born out of my personal blog of messing around on my journey of discovering Linux and, you know, thinking, well, nobody else is making these containers. Nobody else is writing good documentation. Why don't we try and do that? And it's one of those things, like the youthful arrogance of being in your mid-20s, of not knowing what you don't know. Like, there's no way I'd start a project like that today because I know how much I don't know. And in my mid-20s, I was like, sure, what? How hard can it be?
Mm-hmm. That is pretty funny. How hard can it be is usually the beginning of most good stories, right?
It's certainly the beginning of every good Top Gear episode.
So you were part of linuxserver.io?
Yeah, it was originally my blog. So blog.ktz.me sort of morphed into linuxserver.io, and me and a couple of guys just started writing Docker files, honestly, and writing documentation and coming up with some standardized stuff. Like, you know, it's kind of hard to think back to back then, but nobody was really doing the base image thing. Nobody was really doing standardized documentation or you know, CI pipelines or anything like that. It was all just kind of a bunch of people pushing stuff to Docker Hub and hoping for the best. And I just figured that there was a gap there. And, you know, it was right when I was doing my computer science master's, like conversion, like career change, like I was working at the Apple store and I kind of got bored of fixing iPhones and resetting Gladys's iCloud password 3 times in 10 minutes. And so I thought, right, well, this Linux thing looks kind of fun. So I took a career change course and here we are.
That is so crazy. I had to go to linuxserver.io/blog. And I had to confirm that this is accurate because, like, linuxserver.io, if you've been in this world like you are, obviously, that you're the original person of this. So I'm not speaking to you. I'm speaking to the audience when I say this. Then you know that there's a lot of really good Docker images out there that are hosted and maintained and supported by linuxserver.io. And I had no idea if I went to page 16 of the pagination of this blog, I would find Ironic Badger again. And again, yep. And again. Holy moly. That's what I love about podcasting. Is
August 2013. Look at that. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I knew that you were cool, but I didn't know you were this cool, Alex. You're pretty cool, man.
Well, I mean, I'm not involved with the project anymore. They do a fantastic...
Doesn't matter. Like, you began a movement. That's cool.
They do a fantastic job maintaining a bunch of stuff, and they're always adding new containers and things like that. But
yeah.
After a while, it made sense to split out my personal blog from linuxserver.io. So blog.ktz.me does exist again, and I don't write as much as I should, but...
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Gosh, this is not supposed to be an interview show. This is supposed to be friends, and we're supposed to talk about things, not interview you. But I feel like, gosh, now I need to ask you more questions about just, I suppose... So you mentioned CS degree. I think you said master's degree in CS. Is that right?
Yeah.
When you're speaking there, I was enamored by your history and then trying desperately to listen at the same time and catch the details. You know, we podcasters have to multitask, right? We have to guide the conversation, keep it entertaining, and it's also true. Listen, which really, I think, overall is a muscle memory skill set you over time build. But I'll digress. I can't believe this. Back in 2013, this is a long time. I mean, this is not that long ago, but tech moves fast. It's like a decade-ish ago, like it's 11 years at this point.
Yeah, and back then you were crazy if you were running containers in production, and now you're kind of crazy if you're not.
Right. Like, is there any other way?
Yeah. No, well, I mean, Amazon might have you think otherwise, but I think there are certain use cases where containers just don't make sense. You know, like I worked for a bank in London for a bit, and they had like Oracle databases and, you know, crazy, like, even 10 seconds of downtime cost more than my annual salary to the company, you know? So it's like the stakes are a bit higher and they want Oracle to do their thing. And the databases are just a monster. But, you know, what I found interesting was, you know, you mentioned Perfect Media Services, how we ended up down this road. I was looking for the first post and it was February, 2016 was the first Perfect Media Server, like post on Linux server. And it was putting together some of the pieces of the jigsaw. And the absolute most important piece was something called MergerFS.
Mm-hmm.
The developer of that software actually lives in Austin. You should probably get him on this show and talk to him. He works for Morgan Stanley. He's a pretty interesting guy. He was at Texas Linux Fest, so I got the chance to meet him. Antonio, his name is. Anyway, this is the magic sauce because it allows, MergerFS allows you to take multiple hard drives of different sizes, of different file systems, and bring them together under a single mount point.
Mm.
So you could have 10 hard drives, you know, of any size, of any file system, and then you just go to a single directory on your Linux system, and all 10 of those drives appear under that one system as if they were just one big drive. Which, if you think about it, that's what a lot of people have been trying to do for a long time using RAID, is to try and take this JBOD, it's just a bunch of disks, and kind of bring them together in some kind of a unified fashion. But the downside of RAID or ZFS or any of these kinds of drive pooling systems that existed before was that you had to commit up front to like your VDEV layout as part of your ZFS pool, for example. Like you can't easily expand a ZFS pool even now. They've added dynamic RAID expansion, but it's still like mirrored VDEVs are probably still the best way to go. And then, you know, that means you've got to buy a minimum two hard drives at a time. And back in 2016, like I didn't have the scratch to do that. Like I just wanted to buy a 1, 2, 3, 4 terabyte hard drive, whatever was the biggest one back then, throw it in my media server and call it good for a you know, 6 months to a year until I could afford another one. And that's kind of how it grew. I mean, things are a little different now. Hard drives are in the 20 terabyte range, but still the same principles do apply.
MergerFS. So it sounds like maybe you're probably a fan of ZFS, obviously, but maybe do you not use ZFS then in your media server? Do you prefer MergerFS?
I have different tiers. So my media collection, as I'm going to skirt around the bush a little bit here because we have to be a little careful, but is backed up on the internet, so to speak. Like if that went away tomorrow, I wouldn't lose any sleep.
How many terabytes is that?
I don't know. I keep getting to sort of the 100 terabyte-ish range and then having a mass clear out right back down to like 20 or 30 again and just slowly creeps back up over time as family members request things and all that kind of stuff. But for anything that actually matters, that's on ZFS because it has all the Bitrock, you know, protections that doesn't ever serve you up a mildly corrupted file. It just refuses to serve that bit if it can't get the correct checksum stuff for it. Also, you know, backing that stuff up with ZFS Send, and I use Jim Salter's tool, Sanoid and Syncoid pairing to do all the snapshots and replication and stuff like that with ZFS. So I use both now. I have three or four hard drives dedicated to media, and then I have a couple dedicated to photos and drone footage. And well, now I do YouTube, so a bunch of YouTube video, like A roll and B roll stuff that I'll never look at ever again. But I'll keep it, because one day I might need it. You never know.
Gotcha. Well, then let's dip our toe a little further into the ZFS, or as I would say, ZFS, because I get the difference. Let's not go there. But I like the way you say it. It's cool.
I just use whatever, because my name has a Z in it, Z in it. Like I just, Alex KTZ, ZFS, ZFS, like I don't care.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose then, do you go into the TrueNAS world then? Do you simply go Ubuntu or maybe NixOS, or do you, you know, serve the master of TrueNAS and just bow down to Scale or Core? I don't know how hardcore you are, but where how do you feel about that?
Well, it's an interesting question because up until fairly recently, TrueNAS, FreeNAS, whatever, was BSD only.
Right.
Which kind of ruled it out for me because BSD is just different enough from Linux that my muscle memory gets tripped up every single time. But with, I think, is it Scale is the Linux
Scale,
one? Or Core?
Yes.
Scale is the Linux one.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's the primary development target. Things are a little different. And I thought, right, I'm going to try this out. TrueNAS Scale is now the future of the product. And it's where IX systems are taking it. And okay, this must be for real. Until I found out they deploy all of the apps on top of TrueNAS as Kubernetes templates. I just, why? Why do they do that?
Why do they do that?
I don't know. Like, can we not just have a Docker Compose file like everybody else, or, you know, like Unraid does with app templates or something?
Yeah, I mean, Compose. I'm a big. I don't really run containers unless it's via Docker Compose. Honestly, I just think
same.
I'm not gonna like run the command ever as just plain old Docker. I'm always going to have a compose file. It gives me a directory to change directory to manage data sets that might be non-volume. That's Docker thing. You know, like I might store data locally in that directory versus a volume, or just an environment file, or just any sort of config that lives alongside of the Docker Compose YAML file. I feel like that gives me a home, and I don't Docker unless it's Docker Compose, really, personally.
Totally agree.
Which makes sense for Linux Server IO, because that's a big thing that they do, really, is they provide these images, but then they also provide Compose templates right alongside of it that is pretty much copy and paste, which is great for gateway people who are like, oh, like we said before, Plex is a gateway. You find it, you learn about Docker, you learn about containers, you start going further into the Linux world, and next thing you know, you're at least a Linux novice, if not a version of an expert, maybe a multiple expert. I don't know. That's kind of where I feel like I'm not at expert level by any means, but I'm certainly not novice. I'm somewhere in that middle ground, and it really is because I didn't want to run this thing on Mac, and the primary issue I had was not with the Mac platform, it was with the inputs, the literal hardware. I would have USB-C disconnections and data corruption because Macintosh computers, these Macs, are not really designed to be NAS hardware. While they can be, the Thunderbolt port is so fraught with issues. They even have like adapters you can adapt to the port to make sure the cable doesn't wiggle at all. And I would have this thing literally racked into a rack, like a Mac Mini or something like that, right? And any movement whatsoever on the rack, even if you move the chassis a little bit to do maintenance on your rack, like which you are going to do, I would have, you know, port disconnection issues, and I've lost so much data. I'm like, I'm just kind of done. This is not how it's supposed to be. I love Mac. I love the operating system. I love all the ease of it. Obviously, I use it daily as a driver for, that's my go-to operating system. But when it comes to that kind of reliability with a connected drive, Macintosh just doesn't compare to what you can do with a motherboard, some RAM, a CPU, and Linux on top of it.
Yeah. USB connectivity has always been a bit of a risky business.
Yeah.
Any kind of, where it's not contained with a lockable pin.
Yeah. So let's go back to MergerFS. We kind of dovetail a little bit there talking about our flavor of file system, which I feel like any given person who has dabbled with or played with ZFS, which I've never used MergerFS, so I've never done this. I like the ideal of it. But then again, I don't even care, I guess, about the, you know, the true or what you would call the hidden cost of ZFS. I think you linked to it at least from one of the pages you mentioned where you're talking about MergerFS on perfectmediaserver.com. I don't mind the hidden cost of ZFS. I feel like, you know what, if I want reliability of my data, I don't mind commanding Linux. I don't mind manually installing ZFS and managing it. And I don't mind throwing a couple extra $100 at RAM just to make sure I have. I mean, I run ZFS on Ubuntu on a Zima board as a backup target, right? I don't care if it's got enough RAM because I don't care about performance. I'm not accessing that data. I'm backing up to it, so I don't really care. So there is, and then people will say ZFS is inefficient with RAM. I think it's actually efficient with RAM. Like it's using it on purpose. It's not accidental. It's by design, right? And it's better suited for ECC.
Right. If you're reading the same thing from a spinning disk two or three times, it's going to put that at the top of the cache, like you're in the middle of a video edit or something.
Right.
It will bring those assets into RAM and they'll sit there so they don't have to go into disk every time. So it's super efficient. I mean, yes, it uses a lot.
But right.
That's kind of the point of RAM, is it not?
Yeah, that is the point of RAM. I'm gonna see if I can go and find a response. I don't do a lot of tweeting, I would say, or Xing or posting on X, but a potential mutual adjacent friend of ours, Christian Lempa, which you may know from YouTube, potentially. I like Christian, I like his content, but he shared this sentiment recently, and I think he was really just probing for feedback. And he says, I'm wondering if you really need ZFS in a home lab. A simpler and less, and this is where I was like going off on like the inefficiency, a less resource hungry file system seems like a great alternative. And he puts the thinking emoji. And I just responded with kind of what I just said here. ZFS is resource efficient. Why would you not want all that it offers just to save a few $100 on RAM? It is a very amazing file system. Now, the expandability you talked about earlier, where you have to, you know, have RAID expansion or disk expansion. Yes, there are limitations there, but I think those limitations come with knowledge of how it works. So mirrored VDEVs or whatever you might do to expand your pool, there are limitations there. And, you know, going back to MergerFS, which I've never used, how does that compare to ZFS when you have to expand it? When, I know you mentioned you don't use it for certain data, but like, where do you use MergerFS versus ZFS?
MergerFS literally globs together any disks that you supply underneath a specific glob point. So, for example, you could have three or four disks in your air quotes array today, and you could pull one of those drives. Immediately, it would disappear from the pool. There'd be no data loss, because the magic of merger is that each disk has an individually readable and addressable file system on it. There's no striping of the data. Downside is that there's no parity either. So you need a third-party tool to generate some kind of redundancy for a MergerFS array. So something like SnapRaid, which is a snapshot. It basically takes a snapshot of the data of your data disks and then calculates parity on that. A little bit like Unraid, although Unraid does that in real time versus SnapRaid, which does it as a, you know, like a cron job that you run every day or something. With ZFS, as we've said, you have to expand the VDEVs very carefully. But with MergerFS, you can add and remove drives willy-nilly because each disk is individually, like an individual file system. It doesn't matter. It's not going to, there's not going to be any data corruption or anything like that. So if you are just storing a bunch of movies and TV shows and you don't need the utmost in bit rot protection and all the fancy stuff that ZFS offers you, it's a very cost-effective way to build out a small system. The performance is pretty good too. So it's based on top of Fuse, which is a software layer of like a file system that basically runs in user space rather than kernel space. So that there are some performance limitations. It will easily saturate a gigabit connection, don't get me wrong, but you'll use a little bit of CPU as you do it. So things like the Zima board that are a little bit less powerful may struggle to saturate a gigabit connection with MergerFS, for example. Whereas with ZFS, because of all the caching and stuff, they might be fine doing the same thing. So really, it just depends. The answer in Linux and the answer in building servers and the infrastructure is always, it depends. I just, for example, this weekend wrote a blog post about doing a bunch of quick sync hardware video testing to like figure out, is an 8th gen Intel CPU that much better than a 13th gen versus an Arc Pro for basically people running Plex media servers? And the outcome, much to the chagrin of Reddit, was it depends. It depends on what your budget is. It depends on how many streams you're doing. It depends on what the availability of specific used hardware is in the marketplace this month, etc., etc. And the same is true across, you know, when you build a certain system, whether it's a media server, whether it's a network, whether it's, you know, deciding what to have for lunch, like there's always compromises you've got to make. Oh, like my cheese, I've run out of cheese, so I can't make this particular thing. Like, oh, well, I can't get this particular brand of whatever thing I like. It's a tenuous analogy, but bear with me.
I'm following you.
I just think that there's a lot of it depends in our line of work, and it annoys people sometimes that that's the answer, but it's the truth.
Well, when I went to that post, I was like, where is your definitive answer here? And all you gave me was data, and I was upset. So I'm with them. I'm just kidding. I was just looking for, give me the silver bullet, Alex. Which CPU is it? I'm buying it right now.
Well, okay. So the answer is, if you have budget coming out the wazoo, just buy the newest stuff because it's got the most codec support. It's got the fastest cores alongside it. So all the software and codes that you might want to do are faster. It can run VMs. It can run a million containers and not even break sweat. But if budget's a concern, and this is where like the hidden cost of ZFS again starts to rear its head, like the whole reason I got into Linux in the first place was something called PCI pass-through, because I was a poor student doing my master's and I couldn't afford a second computer. So I was like, right, I'm at my desk at home writing a dissertation. I want a desktop computer and I couldn't afford one. So can I just throw a graphics card in my server and then do PCI pass through and then make two boxes behave like one? And we all remember the Linus video, 7 gamers, 1 CPU, I think, from a long time ago. It's that kind of principle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just a rabbit hole. You can always find rabbit holes to go down with Linux. And for me, PCI pass-through was the one that got me. And then self-hosting has been the one that's got me after that.
Yeah, for sure. What's up, friends? This episode is brought to you by our friends over at Coda. Coda is the collaborative, all-in-one platform that brings teams and the tools they need to have together. I'm a big fan of their docs and hubs designed for collaboration because it helps you bring all the things you need, the documents, the spreadsheets, the power of different applications and integrations, and even some intelligence from AI. It's so cool how you could bring the roadmap, the stand-up, the PDRs, the upcoming launches, the OKRs, the resources, all the things that you and your team need into a single place. I love that. That is so cool. And it's not like they're not playing the numbers game. They have 50,000 plus teams that run on Coda, Uber, TED, Toast, the New York Times, and even our friends over at Square. And right now might just be the perfect time for you to try out Coda. Stay aligned by managing your planning cycles in one location. You can set and measure OKRs, as I mentioned before, with full visibility across your entire team. You can communicate and collaborate on documents, roadmaps, and so much more instantly. So if you want a platform that empowers your team to collaborate effectively and focus on shared goals, you can get started with Coda today for free. Head over to coda.io/changelog. That's coda.io/changelog. Get started for free. coda.io/changelog. It's interesting how some version of not good enough got us to where we are. My version was trying to run Plex and various data stores, basically, via the platform I had available to me, which was a Macintosh. And I had repurposed Mac Minis, etc. And yours was Synology. You know, do you recommend Synology to this day? Is there places where you think that platform fits, or is it just never a thing for you? Like, would you give it to your grandmother or to your mom? Like, who is Synology for?
I'm laughing over here because my answer is going to be, it depends.
Oh, gosh, come on. Well, you can't say that anymore. No more.
Well, it does, because there's a lot of useful features in Synology for small to medium businesses. They've got a lot of stuff with 365 integrations and Google Suite backups and, you know, Veeam support for all sorts of like Windows host client backups, that kind of stuff. They did some skullduggery, which kind of ticked me off a bit, with hard drive incompatibility. So unless you use Synology branded hard drives, after I think it's 3 or maybe 5 years, they'll start throwing warnings, whether the hard drive's good or not, saying you are not using Synology supported stuff. And I'm like, dudes,
yeah, come
it's on. A hard drive. Like, I know you want to lock people into your stuff, but that's just
dudes.
That's just not cool. So,
yeah. I mean, even my issue with Synology was similar to yours, where I was coming from SoftRaid on a Mac. I don't know. Are you familiar with SoftRaid by any chance?
I think I looked at it a long time ago, but not recently.
I mean, it's like it's similar to, like, I guess, an installed file system like ZFS, in the fact that it's software RAID, not hardware RAID. And I think they recently, like in the last couple of years, began to have a Windows version of it. So I think for a while there, it was only on a Mac. And I found out about it because of OWC, which is a pretty well-known hardware manufacturer for a lot of Mac peripherals. And so they have these things called Thunder Bays in 4-drive, 6-drive, 8-drive, I think rack-mounted versions of it. And then SoftRaid was the preferred thing you would run as software to do the RAID. And so that's kind of how I found out about it. And my disks and system in that case, while the unreliability of the cable is known, the reliability of the software and the speed of it and the hardware was amazing. If it weren't for that cable, I'd still be there. Like, if the cable didn't disconnect, I'd still probably be back in that world. So whatever. Point I'm getting to is that my experience with Synology was not terrible. It was slow. Moving from a very fast system, like the write speeds, no matter what configuration I did with it, and this is back when I was only on 1 gigabit Ethernet because 2.5 and 10 just wasn't available to mere mortals like us at the time. This was multiple years ago. And now it's sort of a everyday thing now. But I just could not get write speeds. And I'm like, this is just crazy. Like, how are these things in like the very, just very slow, just very slow. And so I got frustrated with the fact that, well, I'm going to spend a lot of money on the Xeon processor in this Synology. Because I'm like, I'm go big or go home kind of person. I'm going to put RAM in it. I'm going to stuff it with hard drives. 8 terabyte, I think was the time, was the drive size at the time. And it was a Xeon processor. I'm like, this is, and I didn't know. I thought, just throw a Xeon processor. That's how you get to speed, okay? That's not exactly how you get to speed. That's how you get to computation, but not speed. And my experience was just that it was like, well, very expensive hardware for really not that great a performance, personally. And so that's what sort of set me on, like, the only way to get there is to learn Linux and bite the bullet and dive deep in. Eventually, I built my own thing, my own box and whatnot, chose the motherboard, chose the CPU. And that was a very fun, very rewarding experience because to this day, I'm like steeped in loving all things what we call Home Lab now, right? It wasn't called Home Lab then, but it is now. And that's what unifies us. This single word, it's like, okay, do you speak Home Lab? Okay, we could be friends kind of thing. So,
and it all started from a Plex server. Slippery slope.
It is a slippery slope. Yeah, it absolutely is. So I guess you would not recommend, or you do recommend Synology in certain cases, but you would not personally use it yourself because you've transcended that.
They're an appliance, aren't they? They are good at doing, so remote backup system, for example. I have one in my infrastructure at my mum's house in England, and I use, so I've got two offsite backups. One is at my mother-in-law's house, which is my old English. So when I emigrated 6 years ago, I left my old server in England full of the old hard drives. And I'm like, right, I'm just going to leave this in a closet. It's just going to run until the end of time. When we went back a couple of years ago, I upgraded the CPU and dusted off the hard drives and stuff. So it still works. It still goes just fine. It's got like 20 terabytes worth of ZFS drives in it. And it's a remote endpoint that I connect to over Tailscale. The other one is the Synology box at my mum's house. And I use something called Restic, which is a file-based backup system. Mm-hmm. And I configure that using a tool called AutoRestic. And I use that combined with MinIO and S3 running on the Synology to do file-based backups, because obviously ZFS send is a block level thing, whereas Restic is file-based. So you've got two, like a separation of concerns there. If there's ever any issues with my ZFS snapshots getting balked for some reason, like I've got a completely separate system, again, over Tailscale to another box somewhere in England using Restic. So that's what I use it for. And the performance, I couldn't care less whether it's, you know, half gigabit or 10 gigabit speeds or whatever, because it's over. I mean, my Spectrum upload is going to be the limiting factor no matter what happens. So
Restic, AutoRestic, Tailscale. Got to mention Tailscale, right? You know I love Tailscale.
Well, yeah, corporate shill time. I mean, they do pay my mortgage now, but I used them well before I worked there. In fact, they sponsored self-hosted again long before I worked there. And I made a video for them about a year ago. Or made a video about them. I shouldn't say for them. I made a video about them a year ago, which caught their attention. And they said, do you want to come do that for us full time? And I was like, yeah, sure. So that's what I do now.
Very cool. Well, yeah, we are also sponsored by Tailscale, as you are well aware of. And I also used Tailscale before that. I think I even pursued Tailscale. I'm like, hey, I love y'all. Can you please just find a way to make a value proposition between us? Because I feel like we reach your audience. And that was pretty easy for me. That's cool how you made that video. And I was checking out the YouTube channel for Tailscale recently. And I was noticing how when you took that over, I don't know if you actually took it over, but you're more prominent there, if not the most frequent there. How much better the production is of it, how much better the content is. Like there was, I think Tailscale Up was a conference and there was content there, but it was just sort of like you just throw content there. It was a content bucket. It wasn't a driving force of the information around the product. which I think you've done a really good job of producing those videos. Again, I don't know you too deeply. I've been a fan over the years, but I wasn't like so steeped in knowing all the things you've done. You do a really good job with producing those videos. And that takes a lot of, I would say, skill and then also on-camera personality. Like, you do a really good job of the content and the production part of it,
95% too. Is the accent, though, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you do have, yeah, that is, you know, your secret sauce. I can't, maybe I could do that. I don't know. I don't have your accent, that's for sure.
Every American that ever tries to do a British accent that I've heard, like, goes, hello, governor, like, Cockney.
Oh, I don't even try. I don't even try to impersonate the British language or accent at all. It's just not, can't do it. Can't do it.
No, when people ask me to try and do an American accent, like, I always turn into a Southern yokel, so I try not to.
Right. Like, do you know Matt Ryer by any chance? Is that name familiar to you, Matt Ryer?
No.
Matt Ryer is also, I believe he lives in London. I could be wrong where exactly he lives, but he always, when we podcast with him, he's a friend of ours. He works at Grafana, but he's also done tons of stuff in and around the Go world. He always tries to mock / impersonate me in particular and my accent, and he just doesn't do a good job, in my opinion. But whatever, I digress.
We did pretty good, eh? We made it sort of like 35 minutes in before we mentioned Tailscale. I was
well, you mentioned them, not me, though.
Always pleased when that happens.
But yes.
I know I brought it up, but yeah, it's just how it goes. Yeah.
They might actually be sponsoring this episode. I don't know. I think we got them on the schedule still yet. I'm not sure where they'll land, but I think this may be. It may not be. But I'm happy to mention Tailscale, sponsored or unsponsored, because I'm a true fan of Tailscale. Like, it's the only way for me. I mean, I can do my own VPN stuff, but it's just like, why? I think an overlay in most of my cases is exactly what I need. So,
you know, I found interesting, you mentioned about like video production and things being a bit of a difficult thing to do. I don't think when I took the job, I'd appreciated quite how much being full time in making content was a lifestyle job. Like, you know, when you go to sleep at night and you sort of noodling on an idea, how do I position this particular thing? Or, you know, you're just driving to, you know, taking the kids to school or something, and it's always there at the back of your mind. Do you find the same thing with doing a podcast?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
On the regular like you do?
Absolutely. I think, you know, for example, yeah, if I know we have an upcoming conversation happening, you know, usually in the week or the couple weeks or a topic I want to broach, the exact same thing. I'm thinking, like, well, who's the best person to talk to about that? Should that be, you know, based on a project? Should we have them on Friends and talk about it in a, you know, a more talk show format where it's like more loose and less interviewee? Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's, and you kind of always have to be thinking about not so much unique ways, but not just simply slapping some people together and just talking. You kind of have to have some purpose. And then I'm thinking, like, for example, I'm having Brian Cantrill on this week, which actually will come out next week on the actual podcast, but recording this week on Wednesday. He and I are
just
both
get Brian to shout into some servers really loudly, and that'll upset them.
Yeah, precisely.
You remember that video from like forever ago?
No, what was the video?
Brian Cantrill in a data center with a latency chart of some ZFS servers, showing him shouting like as loud as he could into the server rack, and how that vibration of the hard drives caused a latency spike. It's like a super old.
What?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I'll see if I can find it and send it to you.
Back in his joint days, I bet.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Well, he and I are both, I guess to put it mildly, super fans of Silicon Valley.
The TV show, I assume.
Both, actually. But yes, the TV show. The TV show for sure.
Yeah.
Silicon Valley, the TV show. And I'm wondering if it would upset people if we just talked about that the entire time. And I don't think I'm going to do that, but like, as part of this whole I'm driving my kid to school or I'm driving from here to there or doing this, I'm in the backyard cutting grass, listening to a book, but also side chatting with myself in my own brain, this future of how will I present X to Y kind of thing is definitely there, right? It's like, would I really upset people if we talked about like, what are my most favorite scenes? Could we spend 20 minutes with that? What if we spent 30 minutes? What if we just talked the whole time about Silicon Valley, the TV show? Would that really upset people?
It's got to be when Russ Hanneman turns up with his car with the doors that do this, not this, right?
Not that. Yes, precisely. Yeah. Yes. Or looking for thumb drives in the trash heap. You never know.
They did a remarkable job with that show, honestly, of making it believable, yet entertaining, yet obviously fake all at the same time.
Are you a super fan of Silicon Valley then?
I don't know what superfan qualifies as, but one of my servers is named Anton in honor of the garage server of Guilfoyles. So perhaps,
my pie holes are Guilfoyle and Dinesh. I have
fantastic.
Two pie holes.
That's
so,
good.
I mean, I used to have Richard in there, and I think Gavin was in there as well, but then I minimized because I had two locations for a while and I only have one, so I only have two in one location. So Richard and Gavin were...
I tend to name my servers after favorite fictional characters. Mooncake is one from Final Space. Magrathea is another from Hitchhiker's Guide. And
oh, yes. Oh, yeah, Magrathea. That would be so awesome. You're right.
I have a Zoidberg somewhere lurking around, too.
Yeah, I think steeping culture, geek culture, sci-fi culture into tech things I make or build. Like, my main server is called Endurance because I love the movie Interstellar, and that ship was awesome. And so Endurance is an awesome name. And so my Proxmox box now, it used to be a standalone Ubuntu server. Now it's a full-on Proxmox box that actually has a lot of different services in it. But the main box is Endurance. Love that. So I didn't know you were a Silicon Valley fan. So I guess I would classify a super fan to be somebody who's watched all six seasons multiple times.
Oh, well, yes, then.
Yeah.
I'm a bit of a Mike Judge fan, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I was a bit young for Beavis, but King of the Hill, Office Space, he's just a genius, I think, that guy.
Yeah, Office Space definitely resonated with me. Less of a King of the Hill fan, less of a Beavis and Butthead fan. Definitely more of his, I guess, more adult.
Yeah.
Like Beavis and Butt was a little too immature for me.
I'm still working my way through King of the Hill for the very first time.
How was it?
I think I'm at like season 6 or 7 or something. But it's one of those ones I just put on every now and again. I'm like, oh yeah, this is kind of... But it's amazing how it's still totally culturally relevant. And it was...
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's basically a show about parenting and, you know, masquerading as an entertainment show of the time. And a lot of the stuff, particularly as I view America with a bit of an outsider's lens, I feel like Mike does a really good job of again, in Silicon Valley, of doing the same thing, of giving you the perspective of an outsider, like ridiculing the people, but also empathizing with them at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Silicon Valley, the TV show, is an absolute masterpiece. Every time I rewatch an episode, I see something new and unique and different. And there's like a little detail always in there. And one I shared recently, I believe I shared it in our Slack and maybe via DM to somebody, but it was the fellow that was at the data center. And I believe, if I can look it up really quickly, his name, it was at Malliant Data Center. His name is John. That's right, John Browning. And there's a scene where he is standing in front of the servers and you can clearly see him current because he's the person standing there, the camera's facing. And then you see his name badge on connected to his shirt pocket. And you see young John clearly in his name badge, right? It's got his photo on it, his name, and he's so young and so seemingly full of hope. And then obviously the current image of him is hair pulled back, kind of frizzled, defeated for the most part, but content with what he's doing. And you see this, you know, juxtaposition between John Browning now to John Browning probably when he started at this data center years and years ago. Like, this photo was taken probably day one of him being an employee there, and he's just so young. He's probably in his, I would say, 19, early 20s in the photo. And then obviously John Browning, as we know him as the character, is not in his 20s. He's more probably, I would say, closer to his 50s.
And as that character ages, then he and Guilfoyle strike up this relationship through that chess game.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm going to move one piece, and Guilfoyle keeps getting beaten. And he's like, ah.
Yes.
And it's just, yeah. I do like that character.
Yeah. I mean, all the characters, I think, are very special in a way. Like, Monica's character arc was really interesting. Initially, we thought she and Richard would have some sort of relationship that never happened. I think they canceled that because it doesn't seem like this should be a love story. So, like, let's tease it, but let's just, like, put the tension there, right? I think she saw his thing when he was going to the bathroom. And there was a joke later on about her seeing it again when he goes to the bathroom because Lori Breen put her down at the end of the hall right in front of the men's bathroom as a way of retribution.
Are all VCs quite so? I've never dealt with one personally, like directly. Are all VCs weird like that? I know they were portrayed perhaps a little rigid.
You know, I think it's a stereotype to some degree, but I think there's a lot of truth in the stereotype. Because every time I speak to people who I know personally and well, where I believe them to tell me the truth thoroughly, tell me that they've had unique experiences with venture capitalists. Are they all like that? I don't know. But I think there's some version of like some truth there. Now, I think Lori Breen's character was uniquely packaged, let's just say. Like, she was uniquely odd. Because I think to be in that kind of position, you have to be such an analytical person and potentially removed from empathy to succeed, right? There's a certain breed of person that's highly successful in that kind of strategic position that the ones who thrive the most are the ones that have lack of empathy or
probably right.
Not very good with understanding.
Because if you want to make a decision that's right for the business.
Oh, yeah.
Of, you know, like outsourcing a certain entire department and making hundreds of people redundant locally, like the whole Chinese factory situation that they cover.
Right.
You know,
with Gavin, he's like, I don't care. This is not the new China. I want the old China.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Why are these kids here singing to me? Get them out there working. Like, it's a bad, it's a bad demeanor to have as a human being. But that was his, he's like, I'm here for a reason. Build my boxes. Well, it sounds like you and I could probably talk about Silicon Valley for a whole entire show, too. So maybe we should.
It depends. If we're agreement on whether Jackson Hole is closer than.
Oh, it's definitely further. I think Gavin proved that with the 10 flights he made. What was his name? His sidekick. Yeah. What was his name? I try to remember all the characters' names very well.
It escapes me, too. So
Hoover. Hoover was his name. Love that character, too. Gosh, I mean, like the way he was going to like throw down on. Patrice was her name. When she was talking crap, he says, like, some would argue that none of the things you ever invented was actually good for the company. It never made money. It would have been better if you didn't invent those things at all. And he's going to, like, swole up on her and, like, attack her. And Gavin was like, stop that, Hoover. Anyways, back to some home lab stuff. Gosh, we could probably go on about that. So I was also catching up with your current stuff, your blog, as you'd mentioned. blog.ktz.me, which is a cool domain. And you mentioned a while back, and I haven't played with this personally yet, and I know you have a YouTube video on it. It is on the Tailscale user, or I suppose channel on YouTube. And you built out an OpenSense box here in your blog back in 2023, like last year sometime. Like, not that old. So if you built this recently, it's still current for you. Like, November to now is not that far. So this is not ancient history, but it does. It's a bit. It's not this year.
Well, that box is actually pretty ancient. I built it the week I emigrated to America, but I only finally got around because doing a podcast do, I quite often mention OpenSense and things. And folks are like, oh, Alex, what build are you running for it? And I'm like, well, it's this really old i3, what is it, 3225. It's a third gen Intel chip that, you know, these days is worth about $6. So the build is still relevant. I actually got fairly recently a Unify PDU Pro, which lets me look at the individual power draw of each plug socket that, you know, each device is plugged into. And I thought that this box pulled somewhere in the region of 10 to 15 watts. Unfortunately, it pulls more in the region of 25 to 30 watts. Just older hardware is less efficient, that kind of thing. So I am kind of on the lookout for a replacement. I might get one of those N100s or something similar that has a handful of 2.5 gig NICs on it, or I might try and build something with SFP Plus in because I've gone 10 gig in the house since I built this box. Also, I hear reliably that my Spectrum woes may be over soon, that AT&T are apparently going to be servicing my neighborhood with fiber, which goes up to 5 gigs, so I might actually need more performance from the firewall soon anyway. But if you are looking for a fairly cheap-ish kind of, you know, build-it-yourself firewall, it's pretty hard to beat an OpenSense box. So sort of in that sort of $150 to $200 range, you can put together your own mini ITX based system with a really old CPU for pennies off eBay. It just depends, again, I know I'm banned from saying it, but it depends on what the availability of different hardware components are. You may find it's hard to find a very old specific Intel motherboard with two NICs on it, for example, which the DQ77KB is the one that I used in that build because it has the dual NICs. You could look on AliExpress and find a more modern, more power efficient system for not much more money. So it really depends on what you're looking for.
Well, there's a couple of things in there that we can talk about, which is one, should you run your own router / firewall versus just buying UniFi, which you mentioned UniFi and the power switch, at least the UD, what was it?
I've got a lot of UniFi gear in the house, yeah.
And I'm a fan of UniFi. And, you know, in all honesty, my home lab is not so precious to me that I need to run all the services. Like maybe you might be because like you're more professionally aligned with that being a true thing for you so that you can leverage the ideas and the content for your Tailscale job and your personal podcast.
That's the excuse I give Amex every month anyway.
Yeah. So I guess the one thing is power efficiency. You've mentioned a couple of times, which I'm becoming more and more power efficiency focused. Not so much that I'm like, wow, that's drawing so much, I need to cut it down. But at the same time, like here in the US, and I would say in a lot of places, there's inflation of prices for groceries, inflation of prices for our power. And like, I know that my power bill in this summer is likely going to be around $300 to $400 a month. And that's insane, right? It's just insane to think like that's a norm.
Well, when I emigrated 6 years ago, the power price per unit, so kilowatt hour, was about 10 or 15 pence a kilowatt hour or something like that in London. Where I am in North Carolina, it's 12 cents a kilowatt hour, give or take. So far as I'm concerned, in my personal infrastructure, like 12 cents, it's about a dollar per year per watt, give or take. And I'm totally fine with that. You know, if my rack, which I've got the data now to prove this, pulls 300-400 watts, am I getting $300 or $400 worth of utility out of that spend every year? Well, most definitely, because as you've mentioned, I use it to, it's like a carpenter with his chisels, right? I'm using it as part of my day job, but it gives me a lot of utility in terms of Plex and Jellyfin and all that kind of stuff. But on the UK side, my old UK server, for example, that's at my mother-in-law's house, it's gone from 10 or 15 pence a kilowatt hour up to 40 or 50 pence a kilowatt hour in the last couple of years, which isn't quite a big difference. And it's not my power bill that it's affecting, but I'm still cognizant that I don't really want to be running really old dual Xeon boxes, for example, that are hot and noisy and drawing down hundreds of watts just sat there doing nothing. So that kind of base idle power draw is a big attraction for me. If I can get that down under 100 watts for a big server that's got, you know, half a dozen hard drives in it or whatever, then I'm all about that.
So you would not say that you're aware of the power draw, but you're not fixated on reducing everything to as low as possible. No. You do strive for efficiency though, right?
Generally, my stance in life is pragmatism. It's the reason I'm talking to you from a MacBook today. It's the reason that I don't necessarily, as much as I don't agree with everything that Plex has done in terms of like user data sharing over the last couple of years, I still run a Plex server just for a couple of bits and bobs here and there, although I'm getting closer every day to switching it off and going Jellyfin full time.
But is that right?
That's another discussion. You know, it's just pragmatism first. Like I want to achieve a certain task. I want to achieve a certain goal with technology, with computers, whatever. And sometimes you just have to sacrifice a couple of compromise on a couple of scruples to get there.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go there and enlighten me, because I don't have a reason to entertain Jellyfish necessarily. I'm not in the details necessarily of the amount of user data sharing that Plex is doing. I do think that I've always wondered what will happen when the person who is me that is really only using Plex to serve up my own data, my own movies. And it seems like they're moving more and more into some sort of streaming thing, which I think is sort of turning their back on or turning away from their core audience, or at least what got them to where they're at. Now, is that wrong or right? I don't know.
That's absolutely right. I mean, if you think about the business model of Plex, there isn't really a huge amount of money in letting people serve their own content on their own boxes, that you're just not injecting yourself into that transaction anywhere. Whereas if you are streaming stuff through some internet-based TV service, you can claim that you were the originator of that traffic and probably gain a couple of pennies per stream. Over time, that's going to add up, you know, Office Space style. But the issue with Plex is that fairly recently, sort of 6 months ago, they decided it was okay. This is just one example in a long string of FUs to their user base, I think. They decided it was okay to send all the people you were friends with on your Plex server your watch history. Like, they sent you a little email, like a newsletter, saying, hey, did you know Alex just watched Silicon Valley? And you think to yourself, well, that's cool. I didn't know Alex was into Silicon Valley, for example, or Star Trek, or whatever it is. But then you extrapolate what needed to happen in order for them to send that email. They know what content must be on your box because they've done some kind of a content ID to say, this file is Silicon Valley. Okay, we know they do that through the metadata stuff anyway. But we now know that that must be stored on their servers somewhere. They've then cross-referenced that with you and your user ID. And then they've gone and decided it was okay to actually make that publicly available, air quotes public, to people within your friend network on Plex, which I don't believe was part of the original idea behind Plex. Like, the whole point was to share files from my local box and not involve a third party and allow that kind of data collection to happen. And I just think it's completely unacceptable for them to collect that data in the first place, let alone share it.
So I was right. Tailscale did, in fact, sponsor this episode. So I'm going to put an ad in here for my friends over at Tailscale. Love Alex. He's awesome. This conversation is great, and I hope you're enjoying it. But he also does some really awesome videos on the YouTube channel for Tailscale. And recently, he did a tutorial, kind of a walkthrough of using Tailscale with Home Assistant and what it took to set it up and access Home Assistant remotely via Tailscale. Take a listen.
Under Home Assistant, we're going to go ahead now and install another add-on. So I'm going to go ahead and install the Visual Studio Code Server add-on. Whilst that's doing that, I'm going to go ahead and go back to the Tailscale add-on that we installed earlier and just grab the piece of configuration that we're going to need from the documentation. In the documentation page, do a Command F or Control F and search the page for 127.0, and there you go. We just need these four lines of code here. Home Assistant by default blocks connections from untrusted proxies, such as the Tailscale proxy. In this case, we're going to add the 127.0.0.1 as a trusted proxy in the list here. So I'm going to go ahead and copy this to my clipboard. I'm going to go ahead and click on Start and then also show in the sidebar. And you can see we're basically in Visual Studio Code, but in a browser. And this is running directly on Home Assistant and has access to your configuration files and what have you underneath. All we need to do is paste those four lines into our configuration.yaml file and restart Home Assistant. So I've pasted the four lines. I'm going to go to the hamburger menu up here, click Save, and then Settings, and restart Home Assistant. We want to go back to the add-on section, and under Tailscale, we're going to have to go to the configuration tab for the add-on and click on Tailscale Proxy. This is going to turn on Tailscale Serve. This is what will automatically generate you a TLS certificate using Let's Encrypt for your tailnet.ts.net tailnet name. So if I click on Save here, it will take a moment, but it's going to restart the Tailscale add-on. And so now I should be able to go to HTTPS Home Assistant velociraptor.ts.net, and it's going to load my entire Home Assistant instance over Tailscale with a TLS certificate using the name from my tailnet. And I can log in just as if I was using the IP address and port number that I was before. And you can use this name from anywhere on your tailnet. So any device that's connected to your tailnet, such as a phone, for example, that can now connect to Home Assistant, whether you're in the house or whether you're at the coffee shop or whether you're in Iceland looking at volcanoes. It doesn't really matter where you are.
If you're one of the few out there who have not tried out Tailscale yet for free, you can do so today. Up to 100 devices and 3 users, totally free at tailscale.com. No credit card required. Just go there, sign up, get 100 devices, 3 users, totally free. That's where I'm at. I use Tailscale totally free, and you can too. I'll link up Alex's tutorial in the show notes. Check that out. Tailscale.com. Do it now. And how does Jellyfin compare when you compare?
Well, it doesn't have a cloud component at all. So one of the big issues with Plex is that if your internet goes out, you can't log into Plex. Even though the software is running locally, even though the files are local, you can't authenticate. So you can't access Plex. Jellyfin is completely self-contained and completely local, fully open source compared to Plex, which has a closed core. And Jellyfin, as a consequence, doesn't provide some of the niceties that Plex does, like friend sharing. You have to do this all yourself. User management, you have to do it all yourself. There isn't really an easy way for remote friends and grandparents or whatever to access stuff on your server without opening up ports in your firewall or getting them to use something like Tailscale. You know, it's a lot more do-it-yourself. Like, you've got to bring a lot of the pieces of the jigsaw together yourself with Jellyfin, and some of the clients are, they're good, but they could be better. They're not quite as polished as Plex. For example, they don't have a Samsung TV client. I mean, I don't know the last time I went to a random TV app store and didn't see a Plex client. With Jellyfin, unfortunately, that's just not the case yet. So it's look at the business model, and it's with Plex, the business model is monetize the user's data, it looks like. And with Jellyfin, well, it's a free and open source project with no financial incentive, really. They're just a bunch of cool people making cool, like, it's the spirit, the true spirit of what open source means.
Yeah, I think where I struggle potentially with open source, and I'm obviously a huge fan of open source, but where I see interface meet open source tends to lack in comparison to something that is funded, i.e. Plex has a phenomenal user interface. They've got apps for every platform. And I think if you lean on open source in that way, because there's no financial incentives, you know, there's going to be some sort of diff between one, you know, like my NVIDIA Shield version of my application for Plex versus, or Jellyfin versus the Apple TV version I also run in the same household. And I just, that's where I'm like, I don't want to lean on open source in that way. I would love it if it was amazing, but, you know, who's going to make it amazing? I have no idea. I don't want to sound like a anti open source person, but that's just where I'm
it
like.
It could be you, Adam.
No, gosh, no.
It could be you.
Oh, it would absolutely not be me. I would support.
PR's welcome, right? That's the running joke, isn't it?
That is the running joke. And that's, I think that's the beauty and the challenge of open source, is that PRs are welcome, and that if you want change, you be the change. And I'm down for that. I would be way down for that if I was younger. It's not where I would value my time. I would rather exchange a lifetime license fee like I've done with Plex in a way to pay for it versus pay for it with my time, simply because it's just not where I'm at. I would welcome anybody else who feels they have that time to do so and get value from it. That's how open source works, is you also show up and you give value, and you get value in your career, your opportunities, or you get value as a user, or you get value as a sponsor of the open source, or whatever it might be. I'm not that person at this moment, nor will I be in the foreseeable future. So not anti-open source, but just like...
So which is right then, Plex or Jellyfin? Dare I say the answer is it depends?
It depends. it probably does depend. Well, I think it gets more clear to me, and you know, I may have to make compromises on my user experience if Plex keeps going the direction it goes. Because I've already gotten like this feeling of they care less about the kind of user I am for Plex, even though I've given them a lifetime pass. Like I've bought the lifetime pass that they've asked me for. I've exchanged the request of me as a consumer and have done it a few times too, because I have other users that are in my network. And so I have multiple lifetime passes. But I see more and more that Plex is less seemingly like they're for what I'm trying to do with Plex itself. And so maybe Jellyfin is my future.
It's obvious when you look at the features they choose not to prioritize.
Like what?
Well, audiobook support, for example, has been high up in their user forums for, like, they have this upvoting feature that Plex Pass users can upvote, request certain features. Audiobook support, for example, has been high up that list for many years, and they're not interested. Like, if they were interested in becoming like the premier, like self-hosted, like fully local file serving thing, they wouldn't be adding all of these streaming services and, you know, all this other stuff that nobody's asking for, really, right, other than somebody who needs a bottom line padding somewhere.
You're right. I mean, I think, so I use Plex Amp.
Oh, Plex Amp is fantastic, though. Like,
I think it's great. It could be improved.
In what way?
It's just not as modern as it could be. It's not as fast as it could be. There's a level of caching it can do at the client level that it doesn't do. There's definitely like UX improvements in particular. I think the UI is not the worst ever. I would say it's okay. There's definitely ways it can be improved upon when it comes to like...
But the recommendation engine, the bit that actually matters, is pretty good. And it's on par, if not better, than what you get from the Spotify's and Apple Music's of this world.
Yeah.
And it's all local. And, you know, I really appreciate like their mood playlists and the stuff like that, that it figures out for you.
Yeah.
I did hear a rumor, and I don't know how true this is, that they are working on some kind of a Spotify Connect style Plex Amp feature that will let you stream to multiple endpoints, a bit like Sonos do, a bit like Rune does, from Plex Amp. And if that comes, then it really will be unquestionably the greatest self-hosted media player, but music player, I should say.
Yeah, I think I'm down for that. I mean, I think audiobook is probably next. I'm a big, despite Cory Doctorow being what I would consider a friend and multi-guest appearance here on this show and other shows we have here, telling me that I shouldn't be, I'm a fan of Audible. I mean, they've really done a great job cultivating good content. Now, yeah, their demeanor as DRM and lockout and artistry and, you know, strangling the market, forget all that stuff, okay? I get the books I want.
Well, Audible, as you say, has done a lot, like Amazon and Walmart before them and Sears before them, right? They've all done these things to strangle mom and pop and local, you know, independent media outlets.
Right.
And at least Audible gets people paying for books and authors get paid. That is a huge plus. If you're interested in liberating your audiobooks from the DRM that Audible encases them in, there's an app I can wholeheartedly recommend called Libation, which then lets you download the, I think it's an M3U file or it's like a, I forget the AAX maybe format. I forget the format exactly. It downloads that, strips the DRM, and then spits you out a encoded file at the end, which you can then throw into your Plex Media Server audiobooks folder. And if you're an iOS user, you can use an app called Prolog, which does almost everything you could ever want to basically be a self-hosted Audible clone. So I've got all my audiobooks just there.
Is that right?
And these are all books that me and my wife have paid for on Audible. And so there's no piracy going on here at all. Like, we support these authors and it's fully DRM free. So if for whatever reason Audible decide to rug pull, not that I'm suggesting they're going to, but
they might.
If they decide to change the terms of service on us that, you know, books that are more than 10 years old, you can't listen to anymore without rebuying them or something. Who knows? That's never going to happen to the thousands of dollars worth of books we've bought on Audible.
Yeah, well, that's good. I'm gonna look into that after this podcast and Libation and liberate my Audible, because, I mean, I don't know how you are. Since you rewatch Silicon Valley, you may re-listen to your Audible books. There's a couple books that I re-listen to. I probably listened to both versions of The Martian, the one with Will Wheaton and the one with the other reader that I can't remember his name. They're both amazing. I like Will Wheaton's version of it because he's got that Will Wheatonism that he is. I'm a big fan of Ray Porter as a voice actor. So I'll pretty much, I discover new things to listen to and enjoy because of Ray Porter being the narrator of the book. Love Ray Porter. I can just spew out, if you want to listen to anything I got to recommend, you personally or the audience listening, I have no problem.
Yeah, let's hear a couple at least.
Okay, I'll pull up my list here. Hold music, please.
I enjoy listening to, there's a good balance when I'm falling asleep of like technical, they've got to be interesting and slightly technical, but not so interesting or technical as that they actually hold my attention, but not so boring as that they don't hold any attention whatsoever. So I find a really good one for that.
That's a fine line, yeah.
Is Adrian Newey's How to Build a Car for F1 Nerds.
Really?
It's a little bit of a life story of Adrian Newey, like the big, the famous Formula One car designer.
Yeah.
And that's, that for me is my sort of like I need to fall asleep, but my brain's racing. Right, I'm going to put the Adrian Newey book on and I'll fall asleep in 10 minutes flat every time.
Well, I've got my list up and I will say, beginning with Will Wheaton, I know I mentioned Ray Porter, but Will Wheaton, he narrated Ready Player One and Ready Player Two. Both of those books are in their own places phenomenal. I think Ready Player One as a book is obviously a lot better than the movie, although the movie was still pretty cool. I would say I discovered Nick Jones, which I believe is also a fellow UK inhabitant. I don't know. What do you call yourself? National? Where you're from?
Person.
I think he's from the UK, Nick Jones. But Ray Porter read his series, and it was, gosh, what is, I'm trying to find the, because there's like six books in this series. I'm trying to find the one that's the one I can recommend that begins it. It's the Joseph Bridgman series. So if you look that up, Joseph Bridgman, Nick Jones, I've read them all or listened to them all. They're all phenomenal. It's kind of like an interesting take on time travel. Really, really cool. A more recent one that I took a little bit to get into because I'm not really into like military, although I've been in the military, I'm not really into like military fiction, I say. And I got into Jack Carr's series on The Terminal List. And The Terminal List is now a series on Amazon Prime. And you can go check that out. I haven't watched the series yet, but The Terminal List as a book and then the follow-up, True Believer. I think there's one more book in the series, maybe a couple more. It's really solid. I dig it quite a bit. And then I think my all-time favorite series ever is the Bobiverse. It is We Are Legion, in parentheses, We Are Bob. It is so good. It's a software developer. It's not spilling the story. It's a software developer that dies and comes back AI. That's the whole entire premise of the story. So like if you read the jacket cover, it would say a version of that. You know, that series is like five, I think it's going to be six books deep, but Ray Porter reads it for the author, Dennis E. Taylor, whom I think is, he's actually a software developer himself from Canada turned author. And he has some really, like there's a lot of entanglement in this story around the Bobiverse and We Are Bob and We Are Legion and all the different books that have come after it. There's such a, because it deals with relativity and space travel and time dilation, he has software he's home-baked and written to maintain the chronological order of details. It's that entangled. Like, that's cool to me. Like, beyond, behind the book is a software developer turned author that wrote his own software to maintain the chronological order and time dilation details of all the travels that happen as part of the series. I think that's just like super cool. But Ray Porter, pretty much anything he reads, I will at least pay attention to it and consider, you know, diving deep into it.
The narrator makes all the difference.
It does. Yeah, I think that person really has their job set for them. One I really had higher hopes for was this book by Nathan Heistad and Jasper T. Scott. And I think it was called Final Days. It had a really good beginning, like it had potential, and then it just got really, really different. And then it ends, it's not a bad finale for how it should end, but like it's just, if you go and listen to it, it's worth listening to, but it's not a re-listen in my opinion. I will re-listen to stories again a year later, a year or two later, because my wife says I'm weird like that, but I just really enjoy things, you know? And so we don't have this plethora of really good things coming out, and so I have to kind of go back to what I know, and because I have a human brain that forgets the details or wants to immerse myself even more in some of the other details, I don't mind re-listening. I could probably go on, but that's enough for now. One more. Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir. That's a really well-known one, though, because it was just Andy Weir is the guy that wrote The Martian, which became a movie. Matt Damon was the primary character in there. I cannot wait for Project Hail Mary to become a movie. Like, just because I love both sides, I love the deep, deep book. And this book, Project Hail Mary, is super deep in the details. Takes a turn you would not expect. It's a phenomenal book. Ray Porter obviously narrates it. And I'm sure it would be just as good as a movie.
I noticed that Ryan Gosling is slated on the slate for Hail Mary. How'd you feel about that?
You know, I don't know, honestly. I think, I would say not judging based on his Barbie performance, because I didn't watch Barbie and I'm not against it. I just haven't yet. feel like I eventually have to. And I'm stuck.
Ryan Gosling is just always very dry in his delivery. And if you like that, great.
Yeah, there's... So I rewatched Drive recently. And it had been so long since I watched Drive the first time, which he's the character in. I had forgotten the entire movie. And I actually questioned while watching it, like, have I really watched this before? That's how far it had been.
If I recall, there's a lot of very serious looking goes on in Drive.
There is. Yeah. I don't know if I'm that excited about him being the star in that, in Project Hail Mary, the movie. I don't know. I think, I can't say for sure. I think First Man was a really good movie that he was in. There's several, which was basically the story of going to the moon. That's why it's called First Man on the Moon. There's a lot of good things about Ryan Gosling as an actor. I think he does a pretty good job in most cases. It could be Ryan Reynolds. I think he was also slated to be, and I think he's maybe good for it too. I don't know. There's the comedic angle to the story too. There's a lot, there's some humor in it. So I don't know. I would also be certainly happy with a no-name actor being found and discovered.
Yeah.
Because that's a breakout kind of role.
We don't see enough of that these days, I don't think.
We don't. Are you a big movie fan? I assume since you run Plex, you must be a big movie fan then, right?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I enjoy a good movie as much as the next guy, yeah.
If you had nothing to do for the next 4 hours, and you can go sit down and nobody's going to bother you at all whatsoever, and you got your favorite drink of choice, whether it's tea or an IPA or scotch or bourbon, I don't know what your flavor is, whatever it is, whatever your a little snack, you know, whatever it might be, everything's set and you're sitting down to watch a movie, rewatch or brand new, what are you going to sit down and watch?
Well, every year on my birthday I do just that, and I always oscillate. I have two movies that Guy Ritchie did in the 90s, Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch, and I'm forbidden from watching these movies on any day that isn't my birthday, so that I don't ruin them, because I've watched both of them already about 20 times. And I just love the dialogue. I just love the pacing of the movie. I love the plot. Like, it's just like, it's almost Shakespearean tragedy in the sort of farcical nature of how so many different threads come together at the end. So those two, I can't pick between them. Those are probably my absolute favorite movies of all time. Matrix is up there too, maybe. Probably a little bit down. The first one, of course.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, probably those three are my top three.
So The Matrix, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, and Snatch.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've never seen Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. I have seen Snatch, but I have not rewatched Snatch.
I'm jealous of you because it's such a fantastic movie.
Well, now I have to acquire it and then watch it because I do not own it. And I don't know about you. I prefer to watch movies. Even if I have the disc, I'm gonna rip it and put it on Plex before I even think about putting in a Blu-ray player. I'm just not gonna do it.
Yeah,
I'm just not gonna do it. It's not gonna happen. And what I love, I suppose, about, you know, and I haven't like gone deep on how all this works. I'm just a user, not a depth person when it comes to the MKV format and what's behind the scenes there. But I'm happy that when I rip my 4K discs, that I keep HDR and all the audio codecs that go with it. So it's as if I'm watching the original. There's no loss, which I think is awesome because I have an HDR 4K projector.
And the bit rate's really high too. This is something that Netflix and Amazon and all these guys, they advertise 4K. Well, okay, yes, the resolution's technically 4K.
Right.
But the bit rate between a Blu-ray even and a 4K file that you'll get, even if it says Dolby Vision through like Apple TV Plus or whatever, the bitrate of the, you can just tell, like if you have an OLED TV or something and you're looking at this thing and you can just tell one is significantly more, it's got more meat to it than the other, more fidelity to it than the other. It's not like lossless audio where you have to have the perfect headphones and the perfect speakers and all that and quiet room and actually be focused and listening to hear the timbre of the snare or something. Like, no, high video bitrate makes a huge difference.
Yeah. So I assume you own Snatch. You have it on your Plex machine?
I bought the DVDs as a student long, long, long time ago. So I count that as a purchase.
Do you have then the HD version then? Or have you just sort of gone back to the OG DVD?
Probably. 'Cause
sometimes people are like, you know what? Like even Aliens, I saw this recently. There's a there's releases now on 4K of movies from our past. So Aliens, which was the second in the series from Ridley Scott. Alien was the first one. Aliens, plural, was the second one. And this has recently just come out on 4K Blu-ray disc for at-home purchase and whatnot. And I heard there was a big uproar about this because there had been people who had watched it on every format since its, you know, release back in, I think, the 80s. I think it was the 80s. That they were like, I missed the grain. I can't, like, it looks amazing, but it doesn't feel like I'm watching the same movie. And you kind of aren't, because the way you perfect the transfer from the original tape to the transfer process they have to 2K and then an upscale to a 4K or whatever the transition might be for them, there is a grain loss. There is a colorization process.
For sure.
All that stuff. So I guess my question really is, like, do you watch the DVD version of it because you're a purist? Or can you? Would you be okay no. with the Blu-ray version of it?
No, I think that the transfer is really important. So you look at things like the Criterion Collection, and they go through huge, they go to huge lengths about how they do the transfers from the negatives to, you know, like remaster them for high definition releases. And I think, you know, the release makes a pretty big difference, but you can lose some of the nuance by having it be a different format than what you watched it in originally. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, we didn't realize it was May the 4th, but we ended up going to the cinema to watch Star Wars Episode 1 at the cinema on May the 4th. Obviously, Star Wars Day.
You didn't do that on purpose?
No, we didn't. And it was only when I stood up at the end of...
It's May the 4th, man.
I know. And we stood up at the end of the movie, and I looked at my phone, and I said to my wife, it's May the 4th. That's why this is on. That's why...
That makes sense.
We only realized at the end, but... That movie held up, and I will tell you, in the setting of it being in a proper cinema, like, I had a Vision Pro for a couple of weeks, and that thing I thought was the best movie watching experience I'd ever had. Like, for on a plane and stuff, I still hold that to be true, but nothing quite beats going to an actual cinema with popcorn and the noises and the people around you giggling at Jar Jar Binks' stupidity. And, like, you know, it's just... We figured it out a long time ago. Like, the cinema is where it's at. Like, can we just keep that going? And
well, then you also have directors like Christopher Nolan, who, when he creates films, he creates them for the cinema. Mm-hmm. And Tenet, one of his more recent films, and I think potentially even Oppenheimer too, is criticized for the at-home experience because it doesn't sound right. In quotes, sound right. And the dialogue is a little off. That's because, like, cinemas sound different because it has a massive center channel that all the action and initial kabooms and dialogue come from. Like, it's just a massive speaker. It's a series of speakers, even. And the sound design of the system, the actual hardware system, is uniquely, not even apples to apples, different than anything you would ever have at home. That being said, I don't know about you and what how deep you go, but I had to, in my newest house I built, which we moved to Austin 2 years ago, we built a house. In my last home, I was, for the first time ever in my life, I actually had a room dedicated to be a media room, and it was big enough to actually be a theater. And because I'd built it, I was able to wire it. Mm. And so because I was able to wire it, I can place speakers wherever I wanted, and I could also place where I could put a projector because the room was big enough. And so I did that in this newest house as well. And for those who listen to the show, they may have heard me say this already, but you're new here. So I'll tell you, but it might be a repeat for them. I have a 4K laser HDR projector. It is the Epson LS12000. If you have researched any projectors, this is a really phenomenal one to get at home for your home theater. I have Klipsch THX cinema speakers in wall. Center channels behind the screen. I have a 120-inch acoustically transparent screen that allows you to have the speakers behind it. So my center channel is behind the actual screen. When I did all the installation, I made sure that the speakers were on an even playing field, an even plane, so that whenever the plane or helicopter or whatever happens and it goes around the room, that it's not like low, then high, then low, then high. It's on a single audible plane. And then I topped it all off with actual cinema seats. And so we have got
awesome.
Two rows, a set of four and a set of three, because we have family who comes over. And that's my, that's why I'm such a purist when it comes to, like when I mentioned before, the HDR being present in the 4K transfer from the disc through MakeMKV to being played through Plex. And
you didn't fancy a kaleidoscope, like Blu-ray disc auto changer then?
I haven't tried it.
I think they're like 25 grand, so I can understand why not.
Oh gosh, yeah. I think, okay, yeah, so I thought you were talking about software. I'm like, yeah, I would never, I would probably never, no, yeah, I would never spend 25 grand for a player. I can't say I would, that's for sure. When I can build my own, right? When I can run it on Linux and stream it across my home network that is my home lab. That's the way, that's where it's at. So for me, I agree with you. We got there, me bragging basically about my system was because you said cinema. And I agree. I don't go to the cinema almost ever anymore unless I need to get out of the house or there's a reason to really go and watch the opening of a particular film. Like John Wick 4, for example. My wife's like, hey, you know what? You've been working really hard. I bought you tickets. I will not go and buy myself tickets to the cinema. I love the cinema. I went and watched it in IMAX on a massive screen. It was phenomenal. I loved it. It's not a replacement for my home system, but at the same time, like I wait for movies to come out on Blu-ray or 4K Blu-ray, purchase them, and then put them on Plex. And my initial experience with any new content is usually, in almost every case, when I've purchased it myself because I like it a lot, on Plex. And in some cases, I'll watch it streaming. But for the reason you mentioned about bitrate and stuff like that, I just generally don't like to do that.
There's a pragmatic angle to, you know, being in the family room sometimes and not having the perfect or bit perfect copy play. But with a self-hosted media server, it doesn't really matter. You can just play the 80 gigabyte rip, whether it's on a, you know, cheap Roku TV in the kid's bedroom or on the 100-inch projector screen. Like it will just scale and transcode and do what it needs to do behind the scenes.
The only issue I've had, and maybe as host of self-hosted, you know this and you've heard this, but whenever I play 4K files to an Apple TV that is getting access to the network via Wi-Fi, there's always lag and frame drops. But my NVIDIA Shield that is on the same network, the same Wi-Fi, does not have that issue.
I had something with the Vision Pro. I don't know whether this holds true to the Apple TV or not, but something to do with the specific 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi channels that the Pro was using had to be a certain channel in order to stop stuttering when I was doing like Moonlight game streaming across the network. I don't know if that's worth some research on the Apple TV side, but...
Could be, because, I mean, they're both on the same Wi-Fi network. It's not a Wi-Fi issue. It's not a bandwidth issue on the Wi-Fi. And it's every Apple TV that is accessed. Now
no, not bandwidth, but airtime.
Okay.
You know, if it's changing channels, then it has to basically retune the channel of the radio that's broadcasting as well as receiving.
Mm-hmm.
And that switch has some latency and then has to go back to the other channels that your other devices are on, etc.
Well, what else can we talk about as we let people go from this hour and a half fest of home lab and
it's been an hour and a half, hasn't it?
Media and audiobooks and self-hosting and a little sprinkle of TailScale in there.
Little sprinkle.
Got to pay the bills, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What else?
I don't know. You're the host.
You got tell anything me. Else? Any dark, any good, anything left in your pockets?
Well, we haven't talked about cars at all. I could probably talk about Volkswagen Golfs until the cows come home, but I suspect that's a very niche topic.
It is very niche, and I probably couldn't follow you very well. I'm oddly have never been, well, at one point in my life, I was a car guy, never a person who worked on them. I certainly enjoy vehicles, and I'm more of a pragmatist when it comes to vehicles nowadays. I don't upgrade them after I purchase them. I don't do anything unique to them. They're simply a utility, you know, and I'm probably the worst because I drive an F-250. And it just is my massive diesel truck and it pulls me and takes me. In most cases, I'm the only person in it, but I do pull things with it. So I use it as a truck frequently. It's not just a, you know, a Texan Ferrari, so they say, you know, it's which is, you know, in Texas, F-250s are super common.
Refer you to our previous conversation, though, about trading time for convenience with Plex and Jellyfin versus cars and like anything, it's a compromise.
Yeah, it is a compromise. All right, Alex. Well, I'll drop some things in the show notes for people to
to
point back. I had no idea that you were part of and the inceptor of, the inventor of, I guess the originator of Linux, what has become LinuxServer.io. Had no idea before this call. I love that surprise. That's so cool.
It is fun.
And I'm a big fan of your podcast, self-hosted. Big fan of HomeLab, as you know. Big fan of Tailscale, who employs you. So keep doing what you do. And glad to call you a friend. Glad to have you on the show.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure. And at some point, we'll have to return the favor and have you on self-hosted.
I would say yes and be there. No problem.
Good deal. And I will see you in Raleigh in October, I hope.
Yeah, you will see us in Raleigh in October. We are making plans with our good friend Todd over there at All Things Open. Big fans. Due for a catch-up. He's been busy. We've been busy.
Are you doing a live show?
You know what? We tend to do the hallway track. We tend to set up a booth. And I think you saw us how we had set up last year.
Yeah, I saw you last year. I was a bit chicken to come over and say hi because we hadn't met yet.
Yeah. Well, next year you have to. And you have to get on the mic too. Or I guess this year, not next year. I'm thinking like last year, next year. But yeah, you get what I'm trying to say. Yeah, I think that's Jared and I, we love covering the hallway track. There's so many stories in the hallway that you get to peel back as part of how we've done that. And we perfected it over the years. And it's just, we like it a lot. There's some people who listen that don't really care for the sound of the people there. But I'm like, you know what? That's what makes it the hallway track. Like if we were like in the studio, would it sound like we're at the conference?
I've had similar comments on my YouTube channel of like, I'm in my basement doing a server upgrade and I've got my phone out in front of me like this, you know, doing the selfie thing. And people are like, dude, get a tripod. And I'm like, that misses the point.
Yeah, that's not the point.
Like, if you watch any Adam Savage stuff, like, you'll know what I'm talking about. Like, he's in his workshop and he's tinkering around and he's got his phone balanced on like a little arm and it sort of wobbles just a little bit as he's talking. And he made a really good point in it. He was doing an interview the other day that each of those decisions enhances the narrative and tells a story, part of the story at least. Like, I'm in the midst of moving around my shop, so of course my camera's moving. And the same is true of the hallway track. Yes, there's people talking in the background, but I'm at a conference with other people. That's the whole point. That's part of the narrative.
Yeah. We want to take you there. That was our point. It was like, we want you to feel like when you listen, you're standing right there as if you were there, even though you're in Europe or Japan or places we have listeners that are not in Raleigh, North Carolina. If you can't be personally present, it takes you there.
There's a balance, of course. If all you can hear is room noise, then that's a problem. But I know you guys do a good job with audio, so.
And we do. Yeah, we run it through a system, an RX plugin that tones down the background sound enough. Elevates the foreground, de-elevates, I suppose, or diminishes the background to some degree. But we still have it present. We do some processing on it. We definitely EQ. We edit so that there's less of the ums and ahs in there. Not just the ums and ahs, but just the stuff that happens when you have a natural conversation. And in a lot of cases, it's a better artifact in the end. So yeah, we'll see you there at All Things Open. Big fans. And what was the steakhouse you'd mentioned before? Not Sullivan's, but what was the other one?
Angus Barn.
Is it Angus Barn?
Like Angus Beef.
Angus Barn. Okay. That's in downtown?
It's like a 10-minute, 15-minute Uber away. But okay. Make a reservation because it's often extremely busy.
Would you say like a week's in advance? Like if I knew we were going in October or whatever date is?
Just make one as soon as you can.
Angus
because
Barn.
It fills up pretty quick. And it's got a bit of a price tag. I'll warn you up front, but it's good stuff.
Any good steakhouse is going to have a price tag.
Yeah, of course. But
we usually drop some coin when we go there. Because it's usually like we haven't seen each other in 6 months or 4 months, Jared and I. And so like, let's go out and celebrate our hard work and enjoy some time together. The last time when we were at Sullivan's, I got a smoked, I think he did as well, a smoked old fashioned.
Ooh, that sounds good.
And they bring it out in like this lighthouse kind of thing, like this glass casing with a bunch of smoke. I feel like I'm at like a Catholic mass or something like that. If you've ever been to a Catholic mass during like Ash Wednesday or whatever, like when they're smoking the place up. And like they bring it out and they open up this big, you know, puff of smoke comes out and it's a smoked old fashioned. So good. I mean, that's a staple. Good steak, good bourbon, good conversation, stuffed bellies.
Hard to beat it.
Yeah.
The Angus Barn is sort of up by the airport area. So just to give you an idea of distance. It's not downtown, but it's not super far either.
Maybe you have to join us then.
Yeah.
Since we'll be in the same place.
I'm sure there'll be a few Tailscalers there because we've got a booth. looking for something to do of an evening. So yeah, let's make that happen.
One of the two nights. Let's do it, you know? All right, Alex. Bye, friends. So the perfect media server, does it really exist? I think it's just theoretically a pipe dream. And based on my experience getting to where I'm at today with my media server, and then hearing Alex's story, and then the story of linuxserver.io, and then obviously Perfect Media Server, the site, which we'll link up in the show notes, it's a constant iteration to better. And that's it. You will never be at the end to have literally the perfect media server, although I do like mine a lot. And I'm cool with that. Just keep trying, keep iterating, and always keep learning and enjoying the process. A big thank you to our friends over at Sentry for sponsoring this show. Make sure you use our code CHANGELOG to get $100 off Sentry. And when you use that code, guess what else happens? They give us credit and they keep sponsoring us, which is awesome. So if you have a friend who needs Sentry, or you need Sentry, or anyone needs Sentry, just tell them, use the code CHANGELOG and you'll be helping us. Sentry.io. Our friends at Tailscale, as well as employing Alex, thank you so much for helping us both and giving Alex an awesome job to do. And for us just to give us an awesome Telnet, an awesome overlay mesh network. I love Tailscale, as you already know. And they just happen to sponsor this episode. And that's how it works sometimes. And of course, to our friends over at Coda, check them out. We love them. They're awesome. But a massive, gigantic, huge, humongous thank you to our friends and our partners at Fly. That's the home of changelog.com. Launch your apps, launch your databases, launch your AI, all near your users. And they have an immense, budding, like-minded, developer-first cloud that's happening there. And if you're not paying attention, well, you might miss out. Hopefully, our usage and our love for Fly invokes some curiosity in you. Go check them out, fly.io. And to the beat freak in residence, Breakmaster Cylinder. Those banging beats, I just love them. I head nod every single episode. Every single episode, it is a joy to choose and select all the music that goes into the episode. So much fun. There is a bonus. So if you're a plus plus subscriber, stick around. If you're not, well, go to changelog.com/plus+. $10 a month, $100 a year, closer to the metal, all that awesome stuff. No ads, bonus content, and a sprinkle of extra love on top with some free stickers if you give us your address. It's better. You know what? I think it is better. changelog.com/plus+. That's it. We're done. Thank you for listening. I almost mentioned during the show, but we turned a different direction. Have you heard of Protectly?
Yes.
And they have a 10 gigabit version, their 6-port vault.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it's energy efficient because it doesn't have any fans and it's got, you know, all this stuff. Yeah. I'm curious if that would be...
That's very similar to the one that I'm looking at on AliExpress that's got an N... I think it's an N305 in it.
It's better.